And now, live from Jerusalem, you're listening to Israel Inspired Radio. Here are your hosts, Rabbis Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel.
Shalom and welcome to Israel Inspired on the Land of Israel Network. That's thelandofisrael.com. Ari Abramowitz here, live with Jeremy Gimpel in the hills of Judea at the home that tomorrow is going to be the event of a lifetime. Jeremy's firstborn son, Lavi, is getting bar mitzvahed. The house is crazy. This is the only way we were actually able to do the show. But mazel tov, Jeremy. That's
exciting.
Thank you
very much. The big things are going on in the world right now.
Huge things. You know, there's so much bickering going on, conflict, confusion about Trump. People love him. People hate him. Someone writes a little comment on a family email of mine, and then the family rips in half. Nobody's ambivalent. You know, nobody's like, I don't know. People really, really, really either hate him or love him or one way or the other. I feel like I'm a little bit ambivalent.
You are ambivalent.
I'm not. I wouldn't say I'm ambivalent. I'm hopeful. I'm optimistic, but I'm not super excited about him. I think this could go bad in a whole bunch of ways. And I'm starting to see it right now. And I think we should do that. Let's just start. Let's dive in.
Well, I think it's important just to give background. This was a historic meeting between Israel and America after 8 years of an all-time low. The Obama administration just was a train wreck as far as Israel was concerned.
Yeah, they made Prime Minister Netanyahu enter the White House through the back service entrance once. You know, he was caught on a hot mic with the French Prime Minister Sarkozy talking about, I got to work with the guy.
We can spend 5,000 radio shows talking about how bad it was. And all of a sudden now, something totally new is happening.
New.
In the White House.
New is fair to say. That this is better? I certainly hope so. I can give you that it's more exciting. It feels good.
Do you know what it is?
It feels good to see.
It's like months and months and months and months and months ago, I was like, I want Trump to win the presidency. I think he's going to win the presidency. And you still have not been able to just accept that actually it's a good thing for Israel.
I don't think it's possible to. He may be great, but if Prime Minister Netanyahu whispers and says, don't move the embassy, please.
That's actually what's happening.
That could be what's happening. We'll get into that. But the point is, whether he's a good thing for Israel isn't only up to him. It's also up to Israel.
Yeah, but
do not put your trust in princes and in man, where salvation does not lie in man. Don't put your faith in him.
Yeah, my faith is not in anyone other than Hashem. I'm just looking at the reality in the atmosphere in the White House is a totally different atmosphere than it was just a few months ago. It used to be literally an enemy of Israel that we had to dodge, that we had to figure out a way to manipulate our way around the UN because someone's going to attack us and someone's going to throw us under the bus. And all of a sudden now, it's just a different reality. I mean, just recently, right as the whole thing was unfolding, Vice President Pence tweeted this out. America stands in solidarity with Israel, our cherished ally. Proud to join the President of the United States in welcoming Prime Minister Netanyahu to the White House. It's just like so friendly, so positive, like an ally.
It feels great.
It feels amazing. It's like finally there's like a normal man in the White House that is welcoming America's only ally in the Middle East. It's like normal relations have been restored and it's undeniable. I'm not putting my salvation in Pence. I'm just looking at the guy and he's a mensch.
Yeah, so far I have to admit, you know, my uncle in West Virginia and my aunt is a delegate for Trump. I fought with them a lot. I'm more towards being wrong than being right significantly, meaning that I'm happy right now. Okay, if the world were to end right now, then you know what? I was wrong. Okay, he's so far so good. I really like the guy. And I also respect him.
Wait, just what did you say? Distracted. Just one more? You said you were
a little under the weather. I don't know. I really am. I've been sick. But I'll tell you, I respect him. a lot because he dove in and I thought he was going to take a totally different angle than he did. I thought once he's elected, he's going to start pandering to the Democrats and that's going to be the next stage. No, he's done more executive orders. The whole country's head is spinning in confusion. And as he's in the Mar-a-Lago resort with the Japanese prime minister, North Korea launches a missile and he's just handling it right there at the table with people taking pictures. Everybody's freaking out and he's sitting there just smiling, keeping his cool. The whole world is talking about this guy. Everybody's talking about, and he seems to be keeping his cool pretty well. You know, I got to give it to him. I really have respect for him just as a leader so far.
A character.
A character.
He
a
is
leader.
A character.
That's for sure. That's for sure. So so I thought, you know, we would maybe...
Don't go into the conference.
Go into the conference. These are just a few clips that I pulled out, okay?
That includes working toward a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. The United States will encourage a peace and really a great peace deal. We'll be working on it very, very diligently. Very important to me also, something we want to do. But it is the parties themselves who must directly negotiate such an agreement. As with any successful negotiation, both sides will have to make compromises. You know that, right? I want the Israeli people to know that the United States stands with Israel in the struggle against terrorism.
Maybe I shouldn't have started with that clip, but that's the clip that I started with because that's exactly the part that concerns me. And this is not a new novel concern that I haven't shared in the past. We're friends, we're buddies, things are so good, but there's going to have to be an agreement and the United States going to be involved in the agreement. And do you really want an agreement? Does Israel really want one? And there's going to have to be real compromise. You know, there's going to have to be compromise on both sides. And Bibi's like, both sides. Yes, both sides. Well, I don't like that whole posturing.
Well, you said words that he didn't say in that thing.
Well, I mean, he says it later in the conference. We're going to hear it in the next clip or two. Okay.
Okay.
So, but the point is...
What is the point?
The point is when he is positioning himself again, like every administration has. So I'm not like criminalizing and indicting him as opposed to everyone else. But if he just said, listen, what happens in Israel, you're our ally. We've got your back. You do what you need to do. We're not going to come and start twisting arms and saying both sides need to make compromises. And then Bibi's like... Both sides. Yes, both sides. It's like, I'm the boss. And he's like, yeah, both sides. Me too. Me too. It was a positioning of subservience and subjugation that I don't think is healthy or good. Well, and I don't know why Prime Minister Netanyahu embraces that positioning.
So that's in its own right, and that's true. But the American reality is that they are the strong horse in town. They are the biggest military. They are the strongest economy. They know who they are in the world. Trump definitely knows who he is in the world, meaning it could be that Obama wanted to be another state within the European Union. Trump does not want to be another country within the European Union. He wants to be the leader of the free world. And as the leader of the free world, that's his position on the issue. He's going to be the leader because he sees himself as the leader. Now, is Netanyahu kind of playing into that? Yes. Should Netanyahu play into that? Probably not. But as far as an American president could be, that's about as good as we could ask.
Okay. That's as good as we could ask for right now. But if he actually starts coming and putting more pressure, I can imagine Israel taking moves that are more destructive than we have in the past under Obama, under Trump. Listen to what he says here.
As far as settlements, I'd like to see you hold back on settlements for a little bit. We'll work something out, but I would like to see a deal be made. I think a deal will be made. I know that every president would like to. Most of them have not started till late because they never thought it was possible. And it wasn't possible because they didn't do it. But Bibi and I have known each other a long time, a smart man, great negotiator, and I think we're going to make a deal. It might be a bigger and better deal than people in this room even understand.
You see, that's what bothers me, I like to see you hold back on settlements a little bit, and then, you know, we'll talk about it later. It's such a positioning of the boss that it's embarrassing for me. It's uncomfortable for me.
Oh, my goodness. You are like a glass half empty kind of guy. I've like never seen you this way.
hold back on settlements? So who is he to tell us what to do? In a Jew cannot be in Judea now.
Okay.
We cannot.
First of all, imagine what it's been up until now. Obama went to the United Nations in order to like make it illegal in the Security Council, and now he didn't even say stop building. He said slow down a little bit on the settlements.
Hold back
a little bit. Those were the words. Hold back a little bit on the settlement building. Okay. Thank you. He's a politician, so he's not coming out straight up against Israel. He's like kind of saying words to appease some other people that are not right-wing Zionists. He's saying words that are like some way, he's like a negotiator. So he's like bringing a little bit of politics into the reality.
Yeah, my main issue is really not with him. It's with Netanyahu, and after the next clip, I'll be able to really explain that a little bit more and unpack it, but
well,
go ahead.
Well, so here's, meaning I would like to look at where we are in history and then find a parallel in Tanakh to see, like, is Netanyahu actually behaving properly or not? There's a time where Israel is not yet a kingdom. Israel isn't even a country. What are we? We're called the State of Israel. I don't even know what the word State of Israel even means. But clearly we're something that's not perfect. We're not great yet. We have not hechzarnu et atara leyoshna. We have not brought the crown back to the glory of Israel. We're sort of like this democracy that's struggling. We don't even have defined borders yet. In this reality, yeah, we are not the head honchos just yet. I understand your desire and yearning to be the head honcho, but in a time when we are not yet the kingdom of Israel, then we almost have to look to Cyrus, the king of Persia, who will either declare that we have a right to return to Israel or not. And we're still living in this Ezra Nehemiah time before the Maccabees liberate and before we establish a monarchy, where we're a little bit still under the reality of the nations and we're still negotiating within that paradigm. And within that paradigm, a revolution has happened that the two-state solution wasn't even mentioned. It was like not a part of the agenda of the American president. That hasn't happened in more than 20 years.
I mean, it did come up. No. They discussed it.
Yeah. It was like, yeah, two state, one state, maybe yes, maybe no. Like, it used to be the American policy was there will be a two-state solution, period. And was enforced on us. And now, for the first time, it's like, no, maybe this, maybe that. That's not our policy
anymore. Here's the thing. That's the difference between me and you.
In and of itself, a revolution. But I'm not done yet.
Okay, go ahead.
The next part that I thought was brilliant about that clip was Bibi and I have known each other for a long time. People don't necessarily recognize that because Bibi was very quiet during the elections with Hillary because he didn't know how it was going to unfold. But Bibi and Trump have an actual friendship. They go back years before Trump was ever into politics. Trump has donated money to Israel before. There's actually a personal relationship there. So there's already a bond of trust with Trump and Netanyahu that we haven't really been able to have with any American president because there's actually just an interpersonal relationship that's going on behind closed doors. Who is Trump going to believe more, trust more, rely on more? Mahmoud Abbas or Benjamin Netanyahu? And right now the answer would be Benjamin Netanyahu. And here's the last part in the real kicker. He said that he's thinking up of a peace deal that is bigger and better than people are even imagining in this room. And I have a whole theory about that, but I'll let you talk first because I see you're itching to talk.
I'm itching because you brought up the first point. I wanted to address that, and then we could address each one, but I appreciate that. Number one, for me, there's a reason you and I have this show. From my perspective, it's not to be pragmatist and say this is where we are in history. It's giving a voice and a vision of what could be and what should be. So for me, this is about the principle of it. It would be a bittersweet victory for us to build up Judea and Samaria because we got the green light from Trump. It would be a sweeter victory for me for us to build it up because we fear God more than we fear men and we do what is the right thing to do, whether we have an American administrator that supports it or not. So I'm not super excited about that element of it. And you know, when I brought up the point about Trump and you're like, well, Obama was like this and Hillary was like that, I noticed that whenever there's any criticism against Trump, instead of actually addressing it, people say it was so bad before with Obama. It was so bad before with Hillary. Look how much better it is now. The point is that we need to approach this from a healthy level of self-respect, an understanding of our position in the world, that we are not subjugated. If we don't act this way now, then we're never going to be that way. It's never going to magically happen unless we take a step forward and act it right now. So when he says, hold off on the settlements – you know, it disturbs me. Who is he to tell us about what to do in our own sovereign nation? We're not America's puppet. It bothers me. I'm not saying, of course, he's 1,000 times better right now than Obama and than Hillary would have been. And that's great. But that's not what we don't need to settle for those scraps. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. I'm just saying, well, within the reality in which Mashiach has not yet come, the Israel is not yet a kingdom, Netanyahu is our leader. Why is he our leader? He doesn't really reflect my opinions or your opinions. He doesn't wear a kippah. He doesn't wear tzitzit. I don't think he's Shomer Shabbat. I don't think he eats kosher outside of Israel. Maybe even inside Israel, I'm not sure he eats kosher. Like, he's not a reflection of who we are, but he is a very good reflection of where Am Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael is right now. He really does represent the people pretty strongly.
Right, but so the difference between a real leader and someone that's merely a reflection of the people is that a leader can bring a nation forward, can help a nation evolve and mature and to grow. And I think he's good. I really like Bibi. Of course, I don't agree with him on nobody agrees with everybody on anything. But I think in general, he's doing a good job. But his second guessing is pulling back about the embassy and about the settlements and about all of these things. I think it's hard to indict Trump on anything when Bibi himself is talking still about the two-state solution.
Right. So I'll tell you, can I hear Mike?
But just about the friendship thing, I just want to touch on that. When you say, oh, you know, Trump and Bibi, they have this long-lasting friendship. But Trump also had a very long-lasting friendship with Hillary Clinton. And they went to their weddings and they were friends and the family friends. And then when the interests conflict, the friendship is gone. At this level of power, I don't know how much weight a friendship really carries if it's not among the most principled of people.
Well, let me just tell you why. I mean, I agree totally with what you're saying. But when dealing with Mahmoud Abbas and the Hamas, which are both Muslim terrorist organizations, and dealing with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, if he has to trust one side or the other, Obama's affinity was to the Muslim world. He grew up a Muslim. He wrote in his memoirs that the sounds of nostalgia of the Muazzin calling to prayer, he identified with the Muslim world, even if he wasn't a practicing Muslim. Trump identifies with Prime Minister Netanyahu over Mahmoud Abbas, and the fact that there's a personal relationship there just strengthens that relationship, period.
Yeah, I think it also bodes well for America. It's a good thing that Americans have elected a leader that is pro-Israel and pro the shared values that Israel and America have. It's a reassertion of America's moral fabric, and I think it bodes well for America's future that I did not feel very optimistic about in the past. The point, I made the point. Now, what's your third point?
Well, here's what I want to say. This was the first time in more than 20 years that an American president did not demand a two-state solution one way or the other. That was Bush 1's policy. That was Bush 2's policy, Clinton's policy, everyone's policy. Everyone forever, that as long as I can remember, America has been pushing the two-state solution on Israel, period. This was the first time, and it's a historic, massive earthquake of a change. Trump was not committed to the two-state solution at all. In fact, what he said is there's going to be a bigger and better deal than people in this room even realize. And I now have my own theory on what's happening behind closed doors, what's happening between Netanyahu and Trump, what's happening in the Middle East. And everything is now being executed with a lot of thought. No words are being thrown out there. Everything is being coordinated between Netanyahu and Trump. Every statement that Netanyahu puts out is in coordination, and Trump is coordinating his words with Netanyahu. And I think that the fact that Netanyahu is asking Trump to not move the embassy to Jerusalem now is strategic, I think. And there's a bigger plan that's going on. And I would love to tell you what the plan is, but I see you want to say something.
Yeah, I do want to say something because I've, cutting this conference up, I listened to it numerous times. And when you listen to something 2, 3, 4 times, you start hearing the little nuances. You start seeing what's really going on. Bibi came out with a new novel idea of what he was going to do. This is the clip where he's talking about his new idea, new solution.
We have to look for new ways, new ideas on how to reinstate them and how to move peace forward. And I believe that the great opportunity for peace comes from a regional approach, from involving our newfound Arab partners in the pursuit of a broader peace and peace with the Palestinians. And I greatly look forward to discussing this in detail with you, Mr. President.
So I shouldn't have cut out the response of Trump, but Trump said, you know, I didn't know that you were going to say that, but, you know, it sounds good. It sounds interesting. When you say that this is all coordinated, both of these guys, but Trump in specific, a lot of people, my cousin, and he, you know, he talks about Trump's genius, strategic genius. I think the guy really shoots from the hip. He's very intuitive. He's got some really good intuitive instincts. But I don't know that this is all super coordinated. And to me, it seemed like Bibi was really pulling this idea like, okay, a whole new regional thing. He didn't tell Trump he was going to say that, but Trump rolled with the punches. He was really honest about the fact he didn't know he was going to say that. So it was interesting. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I have a certain way sometimes where I try to get through negotiating or try to get an idea across. And one of my old friends, Eitan Press, said, Jeremy, you're like a ninja. You're like a drunken monkey. And what's the drunken monkey and ninja? Is that the guy looks like he's just drunk. And then as he's like fumbling around the room, he's actually like beating the goo out of everyone in the room, but it looks like he's just a drunk, so you don't take him as seriously. And what I'm saying is that Donald Trump...
I can personally attest to the accuracy of that description.
And I do that all the time, where it looks like I'm just goofing around and I'm putting ideas out and making people laugh, and I'm totally just doing things that they're not even aware that I'm doing to them.
By the way, this sounds manipulative. It's not. It's actually just totally from your gut.
It's just what I do if I want to bring someone closer to Hashem, bring them closer to Israel,
so go ahead.
Bring them closer to Torah. I'll do it in a non-confrontational way. I'm not going to argue.
So you're saying Trump has that?
Trump is exactly doing that right now. I can see right through him. I know exactly what's happening now. He is simply, all of this is coordinated. Trump already knows what Netanyahu's plan is. Netanyahu has already told Trump. They're all now. This is all coordinated, and I'll tell you now what the regional plan is if you want to hear it, because I have a whole theory.
I want to hear your theory because I have comments on it.
It's the most exciting of all theories, because if I could have chosen a theory of a regional idea, that's exactly what Israel needs now to actually end this conflict with the so-called Palestinians. What is he saying, and what's regional? He's saying we have to involve other countries. This cannot just be an Israel-Palestinian issue, because honestly, the Palestinians don't exist. There is no such people as the Palestinian people. Netanyahu knows it. Trump knows it. We all know it. And the Palestinians came out saying, you know, we're warning Trump coming out again. The J Post wrote, Palestinians warn Trump against abandoning two-state solution. And the Times of Israel wrote, Palestinians puzzled by diluted U.S. view on two-state solution. And so everyone's realized the Palestinians are all flustered now. They're warning Trump. And I'm like, warning them what? You're a made-up people. Why don't you make up some sort of threat that we care about? What could they possibly threat Donald Trump with? And the fact that they're puzzled is also kind of ridiculous. Did you know that more money was wasted by the U.S. taxpayer and the world taxpayers on the Palestinian problem than it took to rehabilitate Europe after World War II? Did you know that's how much money has been invested by the EU, by the UN, by the United States? More money than it took to rehabilitate all of Europe after World War II has been invested in this people that doesn't really exist. So because they don't really exist, we need to involve other nations. They're Jordanians, 80% of Jordanians are quote-unquote Palestinians. Jordan is run by a Hashemite minority that was brought in by England from Saudi Arabia. 20% of Jordanians are Hashemite from Saudi Arabia, and 80% of them are quote-unquote Palestinians. That's why the Jordanian flag and the Palestinian flag are practically identical, except for a little white circle, because Jordan is a very natural home for the Palestinians. If Jordan was a democracy, there would be a Palestinian state right there. That would be a regional approach, giving the Arabs in the West Bank, it's just giving them back their Jordanian citizenship, allowing them to be resident citizens in Israel, where they would get their personal benefits, they would get their health benefits, their child's schools and their health care. But you want to vote in an election? Jordan is your country. That's one idea, but I don't think that's actually what he's talking about. Something bigger is going on and even cooler. What is the biggest problem Israel faces in its own small little land? The biggest problem is Gaza. much bigger than Judea and Samaria. Gaza is the biggest problem. It's like an unsolvable problem. That's what it looks like. It's like giant walls. The Hamas has taken over. The Hamas now elected an even more radical leader to their leadership. Like, how does the Hamas even get more radical? What does he want to do? Like, kill us by only torturing us? Meaning Hamas were already hell-bent on destroying all of Israel and killing all the Jews. When people are saying a more radical leader has taken over the head of the Hamas, I didn't know the Hamas could even get more radical. And so Gaza is the biggest problem. Who was in charge of Gaza before 1967? Who controlled Gaza? Because it's, you know, the territory did not belong to Israel. In 1967, or at least before 1967, Gaza was in control by Egypt. So here's another partner we need to bring into the picture. And I think that's actually what's happening. It's not necessarily Jordan. It might also be Jordan. It may be Jordan, Egypt, and Israel all work together. But let me tell you what the vision is. Israel, right before the Trump meeting, if you saw, it was like a headline that no one really noticed, pulled out Israel's ambassador from Egypt. It's like, why are they doing that? That's weird. Why are they pulling out Israel's ambassador from Egypt? Are they scared that something's going to happen to him? That's a question mark. It happened right before Netanyahu went to America. And so I think what's going on behind the scenes now, if you remember, when Egypt wanted to put that bill against Israel that Obama was pushing for, Trump called up Sisi and said, if you put that bill, I'm not going to be your friend. And Sisi pulled back the bill, meaning Sisi sees himself in some way or another under the thumb of Donald Trump. Now, with that in mind, what if we look at the Sinai Peninsula? Let's not call it the Sinai Peninsula anymore. Let's call it Greater Gaza. And now the Sinai Peninsula becomes Greater Gaza, becomes the Palestinian state. And that is going to be done through coordination with Egypt, Israel, and America. America is going to probably have to give enough incentive for Egypt to agree to such a thing. But Israel and Egypt have something in common. We both hate the Hamas / Muslim Brotherhood. Obama, on the other hand, really liked the Muslim Brotherhood. Egypt and Israel hate the Hamas and hate the Muslim Brotherhood. So we both have an interest to actually create law and order in Gaza and the greater Sinai area. Now we create incentive for the Arabs of the West Bank to move to Sinai because we build factories there, we bring jobs there, we give them homes there. And instead of wasting billions of dollars on building a wall or on Oslo or on more wars, we actually create a Palestinian state with regional coordination with Jordan and Egypt, and Sinai becomes Greater Gaza. And that's why Israel pulled out the ambassador from Egypt, because they were nervous that word was going to leak out that Israel is pressuring Trump to do such a thing, and their ambassador was going to be assassinated. That's my theory of what's happening behind closed doors. And everything right now is being coordinated in a way to accomplish that goal. That's why Bibi's like, the embassy in Jerusalem, I don't need it. I don't care. Let's solve problems. This is a problem. Don't move the embassy to Jerusalem right now. Appease the Arab world as you need to right now. We need to solve Gaza and Judea and Samaria, and we're going to do that with Egypt's help.
Okay, so, you know,
can I get a kudos on this theory?
It's a theory.
Is it an awesome one?
Not necessarily.
It's a great one, right?
I mean, okay, it is a theory.
But you're saying you love it. Like, wow, mind expanding.
Okay.
Are you saying that it's like you like it?
Let me just move on. Okay. I would say in the 15 to 17 years of our friendship partnership, the differences in our worldview and approach to things have never been as contrasted as they are right now. I mean, I see it showing up constantly all the time. This whole theory that you are weaving together, it's so much about a battle and totally ignoring the overall war. None of that is actually going to happen. When he's talking about a greater regional issue, all of Saudi Arabia and Egypt and all of the let me finish. I didn't interrupt you. Of all the conflicting interests and the, you weaved this whole beautiful little picture together. You know, when the Jewish people were at Mount Sinai in this week's Torah portion. It says, it doesn't say Vayachnu, it says Vayichan. They were there as one together, one nation, one people, meaning they were united. But there's other times that there's been a unity, and that unity hasn't been a good thing. So unity isn't necessarily a good thing in general. There has to be an underlying, when was it a bad thing with the Dor HaHaflaga, right? The whole world comes together to build the Tower of Babel, and it's called the Dor HaHaflaga from Pilug, from division, meaning it seemed united, but it was really division. Why? Because at Mount Sinai, there was a unity that came together for peace, for God, for truth. There's a reason that emet and shalom are in all of our prayers together. Emet and shalom are always together because for a real peace to come, a real solution to come, it has to be partnered and fused with emet, with truth. And the truth is that Jordan and Saudi Arabia and none of them in any long-term real way are going to cooperate with Israel to really solve this problem. Why? Because they don't care about the Palestinians. None of them do. I have an idea I'm expressing here. They've, since the very beginning of Jordan and Black September, slaughtered tens of thousands of them. They're not caring about the Palestinians. They've been from time immemorial by Joan Peters, a book that you should read, where it explains how the entire Arab world and really Europe also are using the Palestinians as a pawn to destroy Israel with. They have, any one of these countries could take in the Palestinians and solve the problem altogether. Why don't they do that? Because they don't care about them. They're using the Palestinian issue to destroy Israel. So even if we're able to weave this whole super kudos theory of how we're going to take advantage of all of the different incentives to make a regional solution, there's not going to be a regional solution because the foundations of it are not emet. It's not truth.
What is not truth about it?
What's not true is that even if Saudi Arabia...
Not
Egypt,
Saudi Arabia. No one ever mentioned Saudi Arabia.
Even if Egypt is working with Israel on some short-term level, okay, on the deepest level, Egypt and Egyptians want to destroy Israel. And all Pew Research polls show that it's 80 to 90% want the destruction of Israel. So even if there's a short term, the enemy, my enemy is my friend, and we're going to make some sort of little solution here, it's not worth doing because it's not truth. Well, It's just a little Band-Aid. It's not going to cure anything. And here you are making... You yourself are doing it. The Palestinians don't exist. So there's going to be a Palestinian state and... Well, do they exist or not? If they don't exist, why do you want to give a fictitious people that's been invented and created by the world as a tool to destroy Israel? And by the way, don't get your ego too involved here. If I've nailed you to a wall, just say, Ari, you know, surrender. Because we don't need our listeners don't need to hear us debating when you already know you've lost. I've lost time before. I'm just saying. Okay. The point is...
Can I now respond? So I agree that what needs to be built out of this peace reality is truth. Now, here's the truth as I see it. There will ultimately be peace in the world. That's the Bible promises that. It may very well happen through peaceful negotiations. That isn't a possibility. If Israel actually does the right thing, the godly thing, the moral thing... It doesn't need another Armageddon war before there's peace. It can happen through character, morality, godliness, and through God's spirit. That is possible still.
With Hamas and the Palestinians in Egypt coming up with God's spirit and peace.
No, just a second. Now, the fact that you said that...
Because I'm having flashbacks to the Oslo times when you and I debated 15 years ago.
Egypt's feelings on Pew polls that I don't know how accurate they are not a barometer for truth. Meaning that may be what some Pew report wrote, maybe not. Meaning public opinions can switch. 70 years ago, all Germans wanted to annihilate the Jews. They put us in gas chambers, elected Hitler, and that's where the German public consciousness was. But we have a guy that just came to our center just a couple of days ago. His name...
That's my story. We'll tell it. We'll get to that.
I'm just saying that the Germans of today are not the Germans of 70 years ago. So the Egyptians of that Pew report, consciousness can change. That's not a truth that is rooted in the fabric of reality.
This was like 5 or 6 years ago. And we're talking about 90-something... But you're inventing this. You have no evidence, no studies, no alternative research.
I just want to address your issues, though, about truth. So it does not negate truth, what I'm saying. And the second part, it also... Why did Menachem Begin pull out of Sinai to begin with? Because Israel conquered the Sinai in 1967. And then in order to establish a peace agreement with Egypt, he pulled out of the Sinai Peninsula, destroyed a Jewish community called Yamit. And that was really the beginning of the concept of land for peace that may have been an ultimate mistake.
And he supposedly died in a deep depression having regretted that. But go ahead.
Menachem Begin said, the Sinai Peninsula was not a part of biblical Israel. Israel never settled in the Sinai Peninsula, not in the times of Joshua, not in the times of David, not in the times of Ezra and Nehemiah. He did not feel like that was Israel's biblical claim, at least in this time. So he said, fine. He said, Judea and Samaria is something totally different. I don't agree with that. So with that also, yes, are they called a Palestinian people? Yes, the Palestinian people don't exist. There are Arabs, though, that live in our land. Do I want them in our land? I don't want them in our land. I want them out of our land. I want all of them out.
What?
I want them out of here. I don't
okay,
want...
Okay, no, that's...
I'm just telling you the
you're
truth.
You're very much like Trump. You just spew things no, like that.
Do you want them here?
I want the good ones
okay,
to be able
so
to stay.
Okay, so the good ones, maybe some of the good ones, I would like the vast majority of them to be out of here. I would like them to be in their own Muslim country where they have their own Muslim leadership, where they can elect their own Muslim leaders, and I want Israel to be a Jewish country, period. Now, if there are righteous non-Jews that live by the Torah and that accept the Jewish sovereignty here and that would sign on a dotted line that this is the Jewish country and the Jewish, fine, those people are allowed to stay here. But I'm talking about the vast majority of the Arabs, I would rather them have their own Muslim country. Let them be. And where would be a great place to have it? The Sinai Peninsula is really a perfect place for them. It's a great place. And now let me just show you this awesome thing that I just found on Times of Israel, leaked by a minister in the Likud. Times of Israel, we'll read it together. Minister claims Netanyahu Trump will push for Palestinian state in Sinai. That was just leaked by a minister in the Likud. I just found it right now on Twitter. I'm really enjoying Twitter a lot lately because I get all my news there. And so now I'm saying...
That article, by the way, written by Jeremy Gimpel.
No, that's not funny. It's by Raoul Wootliff, who we know personally.
Right.
And he's not the most right-wing dude. This is not like he's trying to push a right-wing agenda of cleansing the Arabs from Israel. What he's saying is like a minister leaked information that behind closed doors, Trump and Netanyahu are planning a Palestinian state in Sinai, which confirms all that I spoke about here. So when we talk about the nail in the coffin on this discussion, I think that the nail is hit, the coffin is closed.
Okay, so let me just
you
ask
are in
you,
it, and it's time to bury
this
you.
Palestinian state that you are so excited about in Sinai. Would you want your family to live along that border? Would you be having, afternoon tourism into that Palestinian state?
So I'll tell you what's going to happen in this Palestinian state if I can continue the theory until its very end.
It just comes down to I'm a purist.
You're a purist. Fine.
Yeah, and like if you, but you're saying no, Palestinians are fiction. But let's give this fictional entity their own state.
Who cares about their entity? Okay, their people.
Go ahead.
Let
go
these
ahead.
People govern themselves out of our land. You want to call it a Palestine? You
this
want to call
issue
it
would have been resolved a long time ago if anyone cared. They're keeping them there as a pawn. Okay. That's why nothing's going to. This will not bear fruit.
There are two people that care now. There are two people that care. Who's the first person that cares? Netanyahu cares. Who's the second person that cares? Donald Trump's wants a, quote, bigger and better deal that no one even knows about now. A totally different paradigm of how to see this. He would love to actually make peace in the Middle East and go down in the history books as the president that struck the greatest deal of all times. He wants this more than anyone. And this is actually viable. And I'll tell you why. Because Egypt is buyable. Egypt, you can buy off, you can pay off, you can threaten. They will listen. They already have. And now here's where I think it's going to get really interesting, because Gaza is a disaster. You and I have both served in Gaza. The poor Arabs that have to live in Gaza, they're living under now the Hamas that they elected. They really made their own bed there. But the Hamas literally terrorizes their own people, indoctrinates their children, enslaves their people. All the leadership of the Hamas are multimillionaires, as their people literally can't afford to buy food. It's a disgusting, horrible regime. Once Gaza is opened into Sinai, so many of those people will flee into Sinai. And then you know what's going to happen? The Hamas are going to go after them. And then you know who's going to come and save the day? Israel and Egypt are going to obliterate the Hamas and actually liberate the Muslims from themselves. That is a very real scenario that could happen.
Okay, they're going to obliterate the Hamas. What about Al-Qaeda? What about Hezbollah? What about the Islamic Jihad?
I didn't say, the Al-Qaeda is in Afghanistan. Hezbollah is in Syria.
I always thought
these
that these
are all different
are,
issues.
Okay, but they're not different issues.
The way to defeat Islam in general? So we have to, right now Israel needs to first just make her borders protected. We have to define what our borders are. And then we can take care of Al-Qaeda and Iran and the Hezbollah. But right now we have the Hamas in our backyard and we have Judea and Samaria that was up until now on the chopping block. This is a historic
opportunity. Listen, when you said Egypt can be bought, they can, and they have been. And the reason that Egypt is one of the largest militaries in the entire Middle East, their air force is twice the size of Israel's. And right now we could say, oh, it's so wonderful, Egypt is an ally. They're not an ally. They're not an ally. They're a tremendous threat. And the reason these Pew Research polls are important, and forget your whole fantasy messianism of Egyptians now being pro-Israel and jumping up and down in the streets. The fact is that you wouldn't take your family to downtown Cairo for a smoothie.
Not right now.
Okay. And why is this all of a sudden?
That could absolutely – the Arab consciousness after the Six-Day War was revolutionized. You could walk through Ramallah. And the Arabs would have parted like the Dead Sea.
And do you know why?
In respect
because
of the
Jews. Because we so thoroughly defeated
them. So let me just tell you that if we were to thoroughly defeat, together with Egypt, the Hamas.
With America.
No.
Oh, with Egypt.
With
okay.
Egypt. The Egyptian consciousness would be like, wow, Israel and Egypt defeated the Hamas together. It could change in a flash. Yeshuat Hashem Keharif Ayin. Literally in a blink of an eye, consciousness can be changed. Israel could be respected. And who knows?
What about the other 22 Arab countries and 57 Muslim countries?
I didn't say it's all going to happen in one day, but let me tell you, if an alliance of some sorts, Israel has now been in the Middle East for almost 100 years as a proper country. Eventually, like the Arab world is just kind of getting used to us being here. That's a good thing. So now there's like different alliances. Saudi Arabia hates Iran. Fine. They're both Muslims, but they're both Muslims. They're Shiites and they're Sunnis. There's a lot of conflicts in the Middle East in their own Arab Muslim mentality. So it could be that it would not shock me if Israel and Egypt became a little bit closer tied, a little bit more of an alliance. Not that Israel should ever rely on Egypt, but there could actually be some form of not peace, but some sort of alliance. You know, when they found Hezekiah's seal in the city of David, it had the symbol of Hezekiah, and right next to it, it had the symbol of the king of Egypt, meaning there is a historic reality where Israel and Egypt were Baalei Brit. We were in covenant together. We were in an alliance together. And under Trump's leadership, that alliance could be recreated. It's not a fantasy. What's exciting about this time is I don't know if my whole theory is totally made up. I just thought of it on my own as I was like just following the news of the ambassadors being moved. This was leaked. What's going on here? But what's nice is that there's a breath of fresh air now in Israel. Our eyes are open to bigger and better things than fighting off the Obama administration. And that in and of itself is a blessed reality.
Okay. I don't know if it's blessed. I think it's blessed. And it's definitely a nice, refreshing change.
Yes.
Okay. But to me,
it could all go
too
bad.
Lost in these details. Anyways, I think we're beating this to death a little bit. Let me just share my favorite part of his speech.
Okay.
My favorite part. Check this out.
You know, they even deny, Mr. President, our historical connection to our homeland. And I suppose you have to ask yourself, why are Jews called Jews? Well, the Chinese are called Chinese because they come from China. The Japanese are called Japanese because they come from Japan. Well, Jews are called Jews because they come from Judea. This is our ancestral homeland. Jews are not foreign colonialists in Judea. So unfortunately, the Palestinians not only deny the past, they also poison the present.
I mean, that was just, if that was his whole speech, then I would be campaigning on the road with him. Because that is the most important thing to say. I just wish he was a little bit less pragmatist like you and a little bit more of a visionary idealist, because he says that. And then in the same time, he's destroying Jewish homes in Samaria. He's been espousing and talking about a Palestinian state in Judea and Samaria. So, okay, you're talking a big game, but that is exactly the truth. This is our land. We're indigenous to this land. We're Jews because it's Judea. And what's that, President Trump? You want us to hold back on building up Judea? We're dear friends, and I love you. We're personal friends, and our nations are friends, but we need to proceed doing the right thing for our country, the thing that is justice and that which is truth, and we're going to continue and make it a point to say that.
Okay, I think that would have been a disastrous mistake. Netanyahu not
I'm not saying he has to say it there
anything.
At a press conference.
Why exactly?
But you should say it behind.
He said the Judea Jew thing, and then let him just build. You don't make announcements. You don't need to upset the whole world and start riots in Israel. Say what you want to say. Talk quietly and act powerfully. So He's already announced thousands of new houses to be built in Judea and Samaria. So he's building. He doesn't need to be a purist in his words. He needs to be a purist in his actions. And as long as he continues down the path of building in Judea and Samaria, then all is well.
I mean, just that one thing when you say he doesn't need to be a purist, maybe he doesn't. But when we talk about he with a capital H, we're talking about the leader of Israel. I think that purist in their words is the most important point. More important than purist in your actions, because this is about the justice of our cause of being here. So if we're not willing to speak the truth, even if we make this move or that move where it's benefiting the settlement short term and whatever, we're still losing the war.
Okay, it's an interesting point, but I just wonder, what would you rather if you had to choose one or the other? For Netanyahu to just be fully truthful and speak the truth as the truth, purist, and then because of that, not being able to build in Judea and Samaria. This is the scenario I'm setting up. Or not speak the truth, kind of lay low on that, and then quietly build in Judea and Samaria. Those are the two things. Those are the two options.
Okay,
which
well,
one
I mean,
do you choose? But I'm asking a question.
But I just want to say that when people set up these binary situations of their own creation, if he had the courage to say the absolute truth, but he's not able to build. He's the prime minister of the country. Who's stopping him from building? Nobody can stop him from building. If he has the courage to speak that level of truth, he's going to actually do that. He's going to actually do that. So I would prefer that he speaks the absolute truth and does everything he can to build. And if it goes head to head, then we deal with that.
Okay,
and
so
it's better
exactly,
now than later.
If it goes head to head. So that's, I think, exactly what he's trying to avoid. He doesn't want to go head to head. That's just not his style. He is trying to do what he needs to do in order to build things, to get things done. And he says, don't move the embassy to Jerusalem. It is Netanyahu that is pressuring Trump not to move the embassy.
By the way,
why?
We should make it clear that that's our theory.
That's my theory. But I'm pretty
not
sure that that's
your theory.
True.
I mean, it is.
But that's his
it
entire
is a
philosophy.
Theory.
You can see that that is the way Netanyahu operates. Why? Moving the embassy to Jerusalem would light up the entire Muslim world right now against Israel, against America. It would create riots in the streets. People would
it
be
would
killed.
Create...
1 second. It could be that maybe you're right. Maybe we do it anyway and we've going head to head. But he's saying that's not his style. He doesn't want to go head to head. He's like, I don't need your embassy in Jerusalem. Let me just build in East Jerusalem. Let me build in Judea and Samaria. Let me just continue to create facts on the ground under the radar that once it's the world is going to wake up and Judea and Samaria is going to be so populated, there's nothing else to do anymore.
The reason I like Bibi so much and I respect him and I have a real love for him in my heart is because I really know that like you, he has the number one focus in his mind is not his own ego, is not his own position, but he cares about the Israel, the nation of Israel, the children of Israel, the Jewish people. That is what keeps him up at night. Okay, so while I disagree in this strategy, but also he hasn't said anything to negate this other than his whole two-state solution talk, which I've heard he's still schmoozing about.
He's still talking about it, but now it's a regional approach.
It's a regional approach.
And now it's talking about the Sinai
Peninsula.
But
if he's still talking about it, in his mind, he's like, I'm talking about the regional approach. If you're going to already start talking about it, then...
No, but how fun is it? Think about what Obama has done. He's said this, we need a two-state solution. We need a two-state solution. The Palestinians need a state. So now, let's say 70% of Europe and the world want a state for the Palestinians. Okay, that's just... And he's saying, yes, I'm for that. Let's just do it right here in Sinai. Sinai is three times bigger than Judea and Samaria.
Okay, I'm just
so imagine. Who's to say no to that now? Let's say we are able to convince Egypt somehow through Trump's magic or money to buy off Egypt and allow us to make a state in Sinai that is three times larger than Judea and Samaria. They want a Palestinian state. We're giving them three times larger. It's huge. We're getting a huge Palestinian state. And now it's like, hey, you're against now a Palestinian state? We're all for a Palestinian state now. So it's just bringing in instead of like going head to head with the rest of the world, he's like working with the world. You want a state? Here's a state. It's right there.
Yeah, I think the difference between me and you, between Bibi and Feiglin, is not so huge. It's just whether it's pragmatism first and principle comes in a very close second, or it's principle first and pragmatism comes in a very close second.
Can we not bring Feiglin into the conversation now? Who's Feiglin in this analogy?
I would say it's me and Fagelin and you and Bibi.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay?
I'll just let that drop.
And I love you and I love Bibi. Okay? It's just different. And there's also different reasons that God created different people.
You know what? That's a great example. And that's why Fagelin will not get into the next Knesset. But he'll say all the right things. Perfect.
I'm just so happy this is all being recorded. I don't know that he's going to get into the next Knesset, but
I know that he's not.
This whole game is such a long shot. It's such a Hail Mary. It's so crazy that we're even here, that to now start being pragmatic and getting fresh and wise about how it all works, let's just act with pure simplicity and faith.
Fine.
Do the right thing. That's it. Can I just play this last clip?
Absolutely.
I believe that the issue of the settlements is not the core of the conflict. Nor does it really drive the conflict. I think it's an issue. It has to be resolved in the context of peace negotiations. And I think we also are going to speak about it, President Trump and I, so we can arrive at an understanding. So we don't keep on bumping into each other all the time on this issue, and we're going to discuss this. On the question you said, you just came back with your question to the problem that I said. It's the label. What does Abu Mazen mean by two states, okay? What does he mean? A state that doesn't recognize the Jewish state, a state that basically is open for attack against Israel. You know, what are we talking about? Are we talking about Costa Rica, or are we talking about another Iran? So obviously it means different things. I told you what are the conditions that I believe are necessary for an agreement. It's the recognition of the Jewish state, and it's Israel's security control of the entire area. Otherwise, we're just fantasizing. Otherwise, we'll get another failed state, another terrorist Islamist dictatorship that will not work for peace, but work to destroy us, but also destroy any hope for a peaceful future for our people. So I've been very clear about those conditions, and they haven't changed. I haven't changed. If you read what I said 8 years ago, it's exactly that. And I repeated that again and again and again. If you want to deal with labels, deal with labels. I'll deal with substance. And finally, one, if I can respond to something that I know from personal experience. I've known President Trump for many years. And to allude to him or to his people, his team, some of whom I've known for many years too, can I reveal, Jared, how long we've known you? Well, he was never small. He was always big. He was always tall. But I've known the president, and I've known his family and his team for a long time. And there is no greater supporter of the Jewish people and the Jewish state than President Donald Trump. I think we should put that to rest.
That was a little bit of a long clip. We could cut it, but whatever. It's a fun conference to hear, even if you've heard it before. I just want to touch on the whole Jared Kushner thing. I don't think it was so wise for the prime minister to do that. Maybe it was. I don't know. But to me, I'm just hearing that for a moment through like some Gentile's ears and be like, it seems like the Jews work with each other and know each other, and every Jew knows each other. Does the prime minister of Israel know every Jewish kid? Like, he wasn't always the president's son-in-law. The prime minister knows him since he's a kid. Like, what is with these Jews? They all know each other. Like, I just think there's something comical and slightly disturbing about that. But I just want to touch on one thing that he said. He said something true. This conflict is not about the settlements. It doesn't drive the conflict. It's not about the settlements. But that's something that we'll have to resolve in peace negotiations. Do you see a conflict between those two statements?
No.
You don't see a conflict between saying, on the one hand, it's not about the settlements.
Right.
And then saying, but we'll talk about it in peace negotiations. We'll talk about the settlements in peace negotiations. We're going to continue with this peace process BS about what are we going to give and what aren't we going to give and who, how much, when, what percentage, when he just said it's not about that.
Right.
So be consistent. You're looking at me like, am I wrong? Where am I wrong here?
Meaning, they want to talk about it. We'll talk about it. But he's saying it's not about that. Don't delude yourself. You want to talk about it in peace and go, we'll talk about it. But it's not about that.
Yeah, no. So what I'm saying is, if he really believes that it's, and I see that look on your face like you know that I'm right.
No, it's not true.
He's saying this whole thing is a facade. It's not about Judea and Samaria. And if you want to talk about us giving that away, it's done.
You know what it is?
It's not happening.
You're just a confrontational guy. You want him to say this?
Do you remember in the army when you had me speak? I'm the biggest pleaser that there is.
But when it comes to like Israel's like stature, you're like the most confrontational guy ever. You want him to say like this? This is not about the settlements. Jews belong in Judea. This is our home. Whoever wants to talk about the settlements, you Donald Trump, you America, you Arab world, go jump in a lake. Period.
No, and not jump in a lake, but pretty much. No,
but pretty much jump in a lake. That's
saying that is not something that is up for discussion.
Not for discussion. Go jump in a lake. I'm not talking about it, period. And he doesn't want to take that approach. He wants to take an approach saying, here is my opinion. It has nothing to do with settlements. This is about global jihad.
But we're going to continue the silly facade.
We can talk about it if you want to. And what my opinion is yes, there are Arabs that live around settlements. They really need to be transferred to Sinai. That's what needs to happen. We'll talk about it because there's too many Arabs around these settlements. We need to move them to Sinai. That's what we'll talk about the settlements. But it's not about the settlements.
And Jared, you remember when I babysat for you when you were 12? Anyways, okay. So I think that was interesting. That's great. I love it. A lot of times people write and they're like, I love your show, but you and Jeremy agree on everything. I think it's a lot of fun when we go head to head, especially when it's like pretty obvious that you're being exposed as the fraud that you are. No, God forbid. I'm just joking. But anyways, okay, so let's shift gears for a second. Let's take a break. Okay, let's take a break, take a breather. We're going to do a little commercial here for a sponsor of the show, Gilly's Goodies. Have you ever eaten Gilly's Goodies, Jeremy?
I have almost every Shabbat, actually.
Okay.
I was eating that before they became a sponsor.
Great guy. Fresh baked mishloach manot, that's what you send on Purim, he's saying, to your friends and family in Israel and in the USA. He ships it to America also. You could ship it to friends and family here in Israel. They've been sending gift baskets for a long time, people all over the world, and Purim is a really good time to send a sweet hug of Gilly's Goodies. Fresh baked goods. It's actually, as far as cookies go, it's healthy. Your wife puts them on the table.
They have not healthy ones. They have whole wheat ones. They have white wheat ones. You know, they have a whole spectrum. But the bottom line is, all of their stuff is really good.
Right. And also, if you're listening to this and you want to send some of these Gilly Goodies to soldiers, you can also do that too. So you could go to gillysgoodies.com for that. And we're going to take a little station break.
Josh Haston here, host of Israel Uncensored on the Land of Israel Radio Network at thelandofisrael.com. Make sure you check out my show every Monday, bringing you the news unfiltered and uncensored, information that you are not getting anywhere else, especially not in the mainstream media.
Israel Uncensored with Josh Haston on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
We are back, Ari and Jeremy here on a great Israel inspired. I want to do that more. Do the clip cutting thing and the debating thing and that whole deal. But we can't dodge the fact that this is a very momentous, monumental occasion in your life, Jeremy. Your oldest son that I carried out into the world is getting bar mitzvahed. What does that mean? I carried him out into the world. We were hanging out in the hospital when Tehillah was giving. We weren't hanging out. You were with Tehillah. But I heard that you had your first kid. I went to the hospital, and I carried him out of the hospital into the car.
Into the sunlight.
Into the sunlight. That's a bond that I have with that kid. What's it like? How does this feel?
It's overwhelming. It's awesome. It's exciting. It's a lot of thought has gone into this bar mitzvah season.
You've invested really a
lot of time, thought, resources.
I think you're going to cry.
Yeah.
If you're able to be present enough, you're going
to
be crying.
I hope I'm not going to be able to stop crying. That's really my hope, is just to control myself enough to not be crying the entire time. But yeah, you know, if I could, what I would want to do is sort of share with our listeners a bit of the process that I went through with Lavi in order to help others that may have bar mitzvahs or bat mitzvahs that are coming up, to give them sort of a guide for the perplexed, a guide for like, what do I do with this bar mitzvah time? I don't really know what to do. I know there's a party. I know they're supposed to read from the Torah. But really, the bar mitzvah is a transition from boyhood into manhood. And there's a few things that Jews got right. Shabbat, the Jews just nailed Shabbat. The whole world should be celebrating Shabbat because Shabbat is awesome. One more thing the Jews got right was the bar mitzvah. It's just the right thing. Allowing a child spiritually, emotionally, psychologically to feel as though they are transitioning into manhood, taking upon themselves the responsibility of being a young man. If you don't do that, then you'll have a 22-year-old little kid. There actually needs to be something, a coming of age, a ceremony, a something. Oh, so many indigenous cultures have something that actually like is this coming of age moment. And the Jews have the bar mitzvah.
Can I just interrupt? I want our listeners out there to know the bar mitzvahs that you may have heard of in America, many of them, and I'll even include myself somewhat in this, even though it was relatively orthodox, have been overwhelmingly diluted and is the opposite of what a bar mitzvah is really about. Getting performers to come in a big party, and that's pretty much it. And a lot of kids say goodbye to their Jewish studies that they had to do for their bar mitzvah and move on. In Israel, it's quite the opposite. What I see your son going through in his preparation for it, he is now diving in.
Yeah.
He's taking it on. This isn't his farewell to the bar mitzvah preparation. Like, you did something that you weren't given as a child. You weren't taught how to lane, to actually read the Torah with all the proper vowelations. Maybe you did it for your bar mitzvah, but you didn't know how to do it in general. You gave your son that gift.
Totally. Of course. Well, so that's the thing, meaning this, the bar mitzvah, I think I divided up into maybe seven categories that if you actually check off each one of those categories, what you will do is create a season in your son or daughter's life around the bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah and allow them to transition into becoming more than just a little boy. And the Torah reading is the basis, meaning every child needs to go through that process. It's like learning a new language. You're learning the new melodies. You're learning the new ways to read it. You're learning the Torah itself. You're going to be standing up in front of the entire community and reading from the ancient Torah scroll as they had done for thousands of years. And what happens at that moment is two things. The father says, Baruch sheptarani mi'onsho shel zeh. Thank you, God, for finally alleviating me from the responsibility of this child, from the punishment of this child's sins. Now his sins are on his shoulders. Until they're 13, every time they make a mistake.
I remember when my dad said that, I was like, uh-oh.
They are on my shoulders. And what that means for him psychologically is like now he has to receive Ol Malchut Shamayim. The yoke of heaven is no longer on my shoulders. It's on his shoulders. And that moment after he finishes reading from the Torah and the father says, I'm done. Here you are, son. And he accepts upon himself that yoke of heaven is a monumentous moment. And for a lot of people, it ends there. But what I've done is I've added a few more dimensions to this bar mitzvah reality that have, I see they've affected Lavi. They've impacted him in a beautiful way. And that's not going to be like an immediate transformation, but he's made a quantum leap forward in his development. And aside from the Torah reading, what we also did was we took upon ourselves, and a lot of people do this, our own personal Torah study. And together we finished about a third of the oral Torah, two full starim of Mishnah, and then almost a half of another Seder. So we're almost like almost halfway.
Very impressive.
Super impressive. And we finished a little bit more than a half of a Masechet of Gemara and Megillah.
Of Talmud, right.
Of Talmud. And so he feels like, wow, I've like swam through pages and pages of the Torah on top of my Torah reading. And just that personal time spent together preparing, because that was actually several years working on that. Just each night, every other night, sitting down and learning together, that father-son time in preparation for the bar mitzvah, knocking off another page, another chapter, that bond was growing between me and Lavi. And then I think on top of that, I wanted him to have some sort of transformational experience. I wanted something marvelous to do. I take him on a 3-week hike through the Golan Mountains, and I didn't know what it was going to be, but I wanted it to somehow be a father-son experience that fused the values and ideals that I would want Lavi to grow up with. And then by divine providence, I was invited to the Donald Trump inauguration. And that was our transformational experience. That was the trip of his lifetime. But it doesn't have to be a trip to America. It could, my son, Akiva, he wants to go on a 2-week, 3-week trek from the north of Israel to the south of Israel and traverse the entire land of Israel with backpacks on our back in a tent with us. And we just walk throughout the land for 3 weeks. That's what he wants. And so a transformational experience needs to be an extended amount of time together where it's just you and your son, you and your daughter. And, you know, because the way the world works is, you know, kids go to school, they come home, they got homework. And then how much time do you actually spend talking to your kids? Thank God for Shabbat, but during the week, it's like maybe an hour here, maybe a half an hour there. When you take off a week or 2 weeks and you just invest in a father-son experience, even a 3 days, 4 days, you're 24 hours a day together, sleeping in the same tent, sleeping in the same hotel room. That was so important. I saw he came back and he felt special. He felt like something had changed.
I mean, just so you know, you've also been very good at that. Nothing to do with the bar mitzvah. You know, there was a period of time, I think it was during some vacation, when most kids would have wanted to play outside with their friends. And
summer camp.
Yeah, and you said, no, Lavi, you're welcome to come. And he went to every single meeting. And he paid attention in every single meeting. Okay. And I know that you're not ever supposed to say like there's ordinary kids, like every kid is special and unique. But if there was an ordinary kid, Lavi is extraordinary. He's one of my favorite human beings. I just can't wait to see what he brings to the world.
Yeah.
He is a really, really, really exceptional kid. You're a smart guy, but I have to credit it to Tehillah.
Yeah, he got Tehillah's genes right there. He's got a spark of genius in him from her, that's for sure. So the next stage, and this also is very traditional in the Jewish world, we have what's called a hanachat tefillin. It's the first time my son or your son would put on his tefillin.
And no, he's your son.
My son. And so I'm listening to the listeners for their son if they wanted to follow this map that I've kind of created. In the hanachat tefillin, we made it a family event. We went to the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron. We all took the morning off, and then we prayed there together, and Lavi put on his tefillin for the first time. And that's already like, wow, he's like, he's putting on tefillin. That in and of itself is like, he's not a little boy anymore. And at the end of the prayers, we all sat down, and my father brought some cakes and some drinks, and then each one in the family went around and just blessed Lavi. And just gave him a bracha from his uncles, from his cousins, from his brothers, from his Abba, from his Ima, from his grandparents. And that experience also was like just another step saying like, yep, I'm changing. Something is growing in me. I'm growing. New experiences are happening. I'm being blessed and sent off by my family. And that hanachat tefillin, don't belittle it. That has an opportunity to really bring light into his life. And then we added another dimension. And that was Lavi did not want to have a bar mitzvah party. Every single one of his friends has a bar mitzvah party. And that's, you know, you get a band and you rent out a hall. It's like a little wedding. And like everyone's dancing.
The truth is, I remember having a party. I didn't want a party, but I didn't have the sort of independence of thought to actually say, I was like, it's that this part of the deal. I got to have a party.
Yeah, everyone's got to have a party. And he's like, no, I would rather not have a party. I'm like, but Lavi, I mean, you're like, you're the first grandson of Tehillah's parents.
This isn't about
this
you.
This isn't even about you. Like, everyone wants a party here. You can't not have a party. I mean, it's this. He's like, but it's just a waste of money. I don't want to do it. Whatever money you would spend on my party, just buy trees and plant it on the farm. And I was like, oh, here's an opportunity. Oh, you want to plant trees on the farm. Interesting. Well, why don't we take on yourself a bar mitzvah project? And so for the listeners that know, Lavi put out a video that he scripted, produced, directed. I helped a little bit in the post-production, but this was his video from beginning until end. And the boy raised almost $10,000 worth of trees that are going to be planted in Judea right around Tu B'Shvat. I mean, it was like a remarkable thing. The thing went viral on Facebook, over 20,000 views. And people from all over the world were donating to plant trees in Judea. Who wouldn't want to do that? And so, you know, there's a blessing that you say at your son's circumcision. And it is Zeha Katan Gadol Yihyeh, that this little boy, that this little one will become a big one. And you're like, of course he's going to become a big one. He's a little baby. Of course he's eventually going to grow up. Why is that even a blessing? And so the sages of Israel say that actually that's alluding to the big luminary and the little luminary, that right now he's like the moon and we want him to be like the sun. The moon, as little children, they just receive and receive and receive and receive, and you have to take care of them and you have to coddle them, you have to nurse them, you have to change their diapers, and they receive and they receive. And we're saying one day this little moon that's just receiving light is going to become a big, like the sun. And he's going to go out and he's going to affect the world. He's going to be giving to the world. And I think that a bar mitzvah project where you allow your child to do something for a cause beyond himself, whether it be planting trees in Israel or raising money for cancer patients, or, you know, I knew a girl, my niece, She cut off her hair, donated her hair, and got other friends to do it for cancer patients. Doing something that is giving something to a cause beyond yourself allows that little boy to transition to feel like, hey, I'm not a little boy anymore. I've actually done something real in the world. And then because we had such a big problem with his bar mitzvah party, the compromise that we arrived to is that Shabbat he'll be reading from the Torah portion, and then Sunday we're just having a very small family gathering with maybe one or two, three friends, and we're hosting it. You made the cut. We're hosting it in a soup kitchen in Jerusalem, a beautiful, beautiful, it's actually a humanitarian restaurant where it used to be a Lebanese restaurant in the center of town.
It's a good cause in and of itself, Hineni.
And the founder of Hineni is a dear friend of ours.
Binyamin Phillips, so
fantastic
holy.
Guy. And then I said, Lavi, how could you say no to a bar mitzvah party now? Now we get to make your grandparents and your great-grandparents happy. We get to bring the family together. We get to celebrate this coming of age. All of the money is going to charity. Whatever food is left over will go to the poor. You can't say no to that. And he looked at me and he's like, you know what? You can't really say no to that. Well, okay, we'll do it in the soup kitchen. But I think that it's really important to put the point on what is the purpose of that bar mitzvah celebration. Because I've seen some bar mitzvah videos that were on YouTube from American Jews, and it looks like, I don't know what, it looks like a giant festival, like a ball, like Cinderella. It's like, what are we celebrating here? And really, I think the essence of that bar mitzvah party, in some ways, it's a goodbye party. It's a goodbye party. Because we have to say goodbye to that little boy that we knew and welcome in the young man that is.
Don't you start making me cry.
And I'm saying it's like bringing all of our family together to say goodbye to our son who is now growing up, and that little boy that I raised is no longer. And it's like welcoming in the man that he will become. And it's like celebrating this transitional moment. And for the child himself to go through those stages of reading from the Torah, of personal Torah study, of having some transformational experience, of putting on the tefillin, being blessed by his whole family, taking on a project where he affects the world. And then the culmination is saying, goodbye, little boy. Welcome, young man. And the whole family coming together, because our perception of our children very much mold and create who our children are. And for the family to come together and together say, we're going through a paradigm shift. We no longer see you as a little boy. You are now a young man, is what allows that child to take on that responsibility and become the man that they need to be.
Well, I want you to know you should be very proud. And I'm not just saying this. You and Dila have done a great, great job kid. And, I couldn't love him more if he was my own kid. Really.
You know what? I know that we pitch things every once in a while out there, but I do have to give a big debt of gratitude to the Waller family. I feel like meeting them, however many years ago it was, and seeing how they raised their 11 children, and I was like, how did they do that? That's the biggest testimony to the Waller family, or there is their family.
But a testimony to you is that most people I know would be like, all right, that ship has sailed. What, we're going to actually come in and force new ways of being? Yeah, that's what Tehillah and you did.
Yeah, and so there's a big debt of gratitude that I have for the Wallers. And for all of you guys that want to come volunteer in Israel, of course you should come out to our center. But if you want to come and tour Israel, the experience of meeting that family for a non-Jew that sort of in the midst of a transition within Christianity, they are probably the best place to go.
I wouldn't even say in the midst of any transition. No transition.
Just if you're a Christian.
Just a non-Jew who loves Israel. Yeah. That's it. That's the place to go. And I also just want to plug one more thing also. If you want to plant a seed here as Lavi is becoming a man, and this is a very critical transition in his life, we'll have on the bottom under this in the email you may have received this in, or in the description under the show, a link to his campaign.
Oh, you know, guys, he's right now at about 9,000. If he could actually break the 10,000, that would just about do it. He would plot.
You know, and then to me, that's a really fantastic investment, because you give that to him and it's part of forming who he is and his self-perception and this tremendous sense of pride and accomplishment and planting and growing the land of Israel. You have a piece of that kid forever.
Yeah, and what's also really nice about it is, you know, there's a lot lot of organizations that plant trees in Israel, but they got a whole overhead of expenses that they have to cover. And some of the money goes here and some of the money goes to the trees. Every single shekel will just go to simply buy the trees. You know, the money is going exactly where it needs to
go. None of it's going to be going to planting them because we're going to be doing that. You know, we have volunteers doing that. You out there could do that.
Exactly. And so that really is a fantastic way to strengthen our connection to Judea, to strengthen Israel, to make the barren land flourish again. It's really an awesome project. I'm really so proud of him. Friends, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Fun show, Jeremy.
Really fun show.
You're a good man. Mazel tov on la vie. And mazel tov to all of you out there. These are exciting times. Feel free. Always reach out to us. Ari@thelandofisrael.com. Jeremy@thelandofisrael.com. And also, you know what? If you're listening to this on iTunes, rate it. It helps get it out there more. And send this to family and friends if you really enjoy it and get value from it. Shalom. We love you guys. Shalom from the hills of Judea.
Hello. My name is Tommy Waller. I'm the founder and president of HaYovel. More than 12 years ago, I made my first trip to the land of Israel. What I saw and heard changed my life forever. I stood with Nir Levi, an Orthodox Jewish man in his vineyard in Samaria on the Mountain of Blessing. There, he opened his Bible and read the prophecy of Jeremiah that said, "You shall yet plant vineyards on the mountains of Samaria." We have the opportunity to join Israel as it celebrates the 50th year of the liberation of Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria. Come join us as we witness the unveiling of prophecy in the Jubilee year. Come be a part of the biblical narrative. Go to HaYovel.com, that's HaYovel.com, to find out more. And I hope to see you there.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is at Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments. Check out their website, www.windowsofjerusalem.com. They've got beautiful 1, 2, 3, 4-bedroom apartments in the best location in the city center. The view, the location, plus the wonderful staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com.